Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking a little bit about the past, the present, and the future of the American dollar. In the post-war era, the dollar has become the primary unit of international finance and trade, a function that it took over from the British pound sterling that was the international currency for a long time before that. And that made it possible, says our guest, Wall Street Journal reporter Craig Carman, made it possible for the world's economy to expand dramatically. But it also encouraged the United States to run up some very significant foreign debts and record trade deficits. To date, the American government, has managed to calm the fears of a lot of borrowers around the world. But some people wonder just how long the dollar can continue to enjoy its special status. Certainly, there are other currencies like the euro and the Chinese yuan that are creeping up on the dollar. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about the future of America's currency, and that is the subject of Craig Carman's recent book, Biography of the Dollar, the subtitle, How the Mighty Buck Conquered the World and Why It's Under Siege. It's published by Crown Business. Craig Carman is a reporter for the Money and Investing section of the Journal, covering international markets and foreign exchange. He's also appeared on CNN and CNBC, and his work has been published in Barron's, The New Republic, and Newsweek International, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As always, is the case here on the program, questions are welcome. We just ask callers to be brief in their questions so we can keep moving along, but of course, anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign, Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So, again, if it would be a local call for you, use the first number, 333-9455. But long distance, around Illinois and Indiana, where the signal travels, if you're listening on the air, or if you're listening on the Internet in the U.S., use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Carman, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just to talk a little bit, I'd like to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about just how significant the dollar is as a unit of international currency. What exactly do we mean by that?
Well, you know, as mighty as the U.S. economy is in the world today, the dollar's reach goes much further than that. The U.S. economy now is about 25% of world gross domestic product. U.S. stocks account for about half, a little less than half, of the global stock market capitalization. But the dollar is a part of more than 8 of every 10 trades in the foreign exchange market, and that market is $3.2 trillion with a T, dollars a day, the largest financial market out there, totally dominated by the dollar. The dollar has also been a world reserve currency and currency of trade unlike any we've ever seen before it. Emerging market countries peg their currency to the dollar. They borrow money in dollars. We have most commodities priced in dollars. And whenever a company in Latin America, say, trades with a company in Asia, chances are those transactions are going on in dollars.
Mm-hmm. So if you ask the question, well, what exactly is the benefit to the world of using one main currency, in the dollar or anything else? And in a sense, you've touched on it, is the simple reason that, well, everybody knows what it's worth, everybody can agree on what it's worth, and it just makes things a lot easier?
That's right. And it's also, in a more sort of pragmatic sense, it reduces the cost of international trade. If everyone has a store of dollars, and when they trade in dollars, they're trading in the same currency, there's no transaction costs. If a European company is trading with an American company and one is in euros and the other is in dollars, someone's got to switch and then there's a transaction cost. When you're doing $1 billion-plus deals, those transaction costs can really add up and take away some of the profits from doing those deals.
Hmm. We can talk, and I definitely want to talk about where things are headed, but just as a way of asking that question right up front, do you think that anytime soon the position of the dollar is going to be taken over by, and a couple of the leading contenders no doubt would be the euro and perhaps the Chinese currency, the yuan. Do you think it is likely that anytime soon the dollar will be knocked off?
No, I don't see it happening anytime soon. Longer term is a different question, but there's there's a system in place in global finance and global trade that is built on relationships that have developed over decades, and these are dollar-based relationships. You know, people talk about, well, what if OPEC wants to change the price of oil to euros and rather dollars? The price of oil is still determined by exchanges. There's three main exchanges in the world that sell its Brent crude, Middle Eastern oil, and Texas oil, and these are all still priced in dollars. And it's going to be very hard for any one country to try and change the pricing mechanism as OPEC. Likewise, you know, the reason so much trade is going on in dollars is because it's been established over a period of years. People have dollar reserves, and the system is built around this. And I think right now there's, you know, shaking the dollar loose from that role would require this sort of vast reworking of the global financial system that certainly during a time like this, very few players seem willing to confront. And just specifically on the euro, because that's the one that comes up the most mm-hmm. as a possible alternative to the dollar, I think that the euro is a bit like one of these politicians that everyone is really high on until they look more closely at it and then they realize perhaps he's not the right guy for the job. The euro is sort of the anti-dollar, but it's not as all clear that the Europeans even want to see the euro used as the world's main reserve currency. The Germans historically have always opposed international use of their currency. They feel it hinders their ability to set monetary policy and control inflation. European countries are constantly complaining that the strong euro is hurting their sales abroad, and making the euro the main world currency would only make it stronger and hurt their profits further. And, you know, perhaps most surprising of all, polls of European citizens themselves constantly come up with very mixed reviews toward the euro in places like Italy and France and the Netherlands, people blaming the euro for their economy's performance and often saying that they miss their old currencies like the franc and the lira.
Yeah. It just, you wonder whether some of the enthusiasm for the euro, particularly perhaps on this side of the Atlantic, just has something to do with the novelty of it, almost.
Yeah, I think there's something of that. It's only been around for 9 years, and it really hasn't had much of a rough period. And also, because it is now the first really credible alternative to the dollar since the dollar became the world's main reserve currency about 60 years ago, there is a sense that whenever, you know, at least in the foreign exchange market, whenever people want to bet against the dollar, the obvious place to do it is to buy euros. It's a big currency. It's easily tradable. And some of the Asian currencies where people see potentially more value versus the dollar, they're just too hard to trade, too thin a market. So the euro becomes the vehicle that everyone uses to sort of express their displeasure with the dollar.
Mm-hmm. And certainly we've heard a lot about, particularly now, fairly recently, with the weakness in the dollar and strength of the euro against the dollar, about Europeans coming to the United States to spend money because it's a good deal, and now about businesses, particularly New York City, I guess, places where they sell consumer goods, taking euros, pricing things in euros, going into restaurants in New York and seeing that the prices are in maybe both in dollars and in euros, which would, I suppose, if you were an American, might make you a little bit concerned.
Yeah, you know, you do see that. But I think rather than seeing it as a sign that the euro is about to steamroll the dollar, it's rather some very clever marketing on behalf of particular business owners. There, you know, I live here in New York, and we always get tourists from Europe in the summertime and around Christmas. This is the first time I can remember so many European tourists coming in the spring. And you know, really, you know, if you go to the shopping centers, and they're just all over the place with a shopping bag in each hand. And I think, you know, some of the more clever business people recognize if you put the euro price next to the dollar price, you're only going to underscore how much money they're saving.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if in most parts of the world, you'll still see the dollar accepted. One thing I think that has changed is that in Europe itself, for the first time, you're actually really seeing the euro favored over the dollar, even in countries in Europe that don't use the euro. I was in Hungary a couple of years ago, and I went into a store to buy a SIM card for my cell phone and get a local number there. And the guy told me the price in euros and in Hungarian forint, and I said, well, what's the price in dollars? Sort of a strange look passed over his face. He said, well, what's the dollar exchange rate? I had never traveled abroad and seen someone who didn't instantly know what the dollar exchange rate was. And I thought, well, in Europe at least, that's a real change.
The guest in this part of Focus 580, just let me introduce again, Craig Carman. He's a reporter for the Money and Investing section of the Wall Street Journal. He covers international markets and foreign exchange and is the author of the recently published book Biography of the Dollar, How the Mighty Buck Conquered the World and Why It's Under Siege. It's published by Crown Business. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As I mentioned, and as you explain in the book, in the 19th century, the world's currency was the pound sterling. And as the U.S. economy gained strength over that time, the dollar became stronger and stronger. And then after World War II, then the dollar took the place that had been held by the pound. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how it is that this happened and what were some of the important events over that period of roughly about 100 years that or a little bit more, and made it possible for that to happen.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story because at the beginning of the 20th century, the U.S. had already surpassed England and China as the world's largest economy. And not only was it a large economy, but it was a very internationalized economy, a big exporter and importer. And yet, outside of North America, there was no use of the dollar whatsoever. It was a very strange anomaly. All the other top 10 economies in the world had some international use of their currency, except the United States. And the main reason was the U.S. did not have a central bank at the time. In the mid-1800s, the U.S. had allowed its second central bank charter to expire. And a lot of people in the U.S. remain very skeptical of a centralized authority that controlled the U.S. purse strings. And, you know, America was sort of founded on the belief of being skeptical of a strong centralized government, and then went straight to the idea of a central bank. But after 1907, during one of the biggest financial panics up to the time, the U.S. decided that it needed a lender of last resort to bring some financial stability to the country. In 1907, they had a call on a private citizen, J.P. Morgan, to talk with bankers and sort of force them to lend and force some under. And it was a job that they decided could no longer rest in an individual citizen's hands. So they put together some legislation with the help of a guy named Paul Warburg, who was a German banker who came over to the U.S., became a naturalized citizen, and helped draw up the plans for the Federal Reserve System, which was a very uniquely American take on the central bank. Rather than having just one single authority, they had a board of governors in Washington, but then also a dozen regional banks around the country, so that it would sort of get over people's fears that there was going to be one centralized body in the capital that would make all the decisions. That law was signed by Woodrow Wilson in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act. The following year, World War I breaks out, and our European allies needed some money to fight the war, and they came to the New York banks looking to borrow, and the New York banks said, yeah, we'll be happy to lend to you, but guess what? This time it's going to be in dollars. And that was the beginning of the internationalization of the dollar. The central bank sort of gave people confidence to use it. And the pound was still the most used currency. The dollar would gain some traction, lose some traction. It went on the gold standard, went off the gold standard during the Great Depression. Then in the next big moment was in 1944 when the Bretton Woods Agreement was signed. And that was when heads of 44 nations agreed to peg their currency to the dollar, which would then be pegged at $35 an ounce to gold. And it was really an unprecedented act because you had had world currencies before, and clearly the pound had been unlike any before it. But this was the first time that all the major countries, at least the major countries in the free world, because the Soviet Union and its sort of client states did not participate, all the countries in the free world officially signed a document that made one currency above all others, putting it at the center of the global economy and financial system. And from there on, the dollar has been the main currency. And one of the more interesting developments was how in the early 70s, when the Nixon administration took the dollar off the gold standard, people were waiting to see what would happen, but in the end, nothing changed. The dollar was a little weaker in the beginning, but it got some of that strength back, and even without being backed by gold or any other collateral, the U.S. dollar is still the currency of choice.
Mm. The fact that the dollar did become the world's currency there at the end of World War II, was that mostly due to the fact that at the end of World War II, the United States had by far the strongest economy of any country in the world?
Yeah, virtually any indicator out there, the U.S. was on top. We had, the strongest military, the strongest economy, the largest supply of gold, the most natural resources, and finally also the will to exert itself in the world. And there's been times throughout our history in which people did not really want the dollar to be a currency used abroad, but by then, they saw it as a way to influence policy and spread American influence abroad.
Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about this decision to end the gold standard in 1971, and that why was it that I think that at the time a lot of people thought that was a very bad idea.
Yeah, it was sort of a least evil decision at the time. The U.S. had agreed to honor gold at $35 to an ounce of gold, and under this Brentwood's agreement, any central bank that wanted to trade in its dollars would get the equivalent amount in gold. And as the U.S. printed more dollars, the ratio of dollars to gold started to fall dramatically, and by 1971, I think it was down to about 15% coverage. Meaning they could only offer gold for 15% of the dollars held abroad. And this was something that the U.S. had been concerned about going back as far as the Kennedy administration and perhaps even the Eisenhower administration, that this was something sort of held over the U.S. head. It gave the dollar strength, but there was always this fear that there would be the equivalent of a run on the bank, that if there's any major catastrophe in the U.S., all the central banks around the world would want to cash in their dollars for gold right away, and the U.S. would essentially have to shut the bank windows, and it would be a disaster for the U.S. economy and, for that matter, for the world economy. And by 1971, they had just decided they had little choice but to end this because the economy was not in a great way, and there was France in particular was making noises about wanting to cash in all its dollars for gold. The reason that decision was so controversial was, of course, now the dollar was backed by nothing other than confidence in the United States. It was actually the first major international currency ever to have nothing but that full faith and credit of a country behind it, no tangible collateral at all. And in the 1970s, the dollar paid a price, and it fell pretty hard for most of that decade. Until Paul Volcker took over as chairman of the Federal Reserve in 1979 and started to raise interest rates to a level that the U.S. just never thought possible, up close to 20%. The effect of that was to slow down inflation and sort of regain trust in the dollar. And the irony, as Mr. Volcker told me in one of my interviews with him, was by the 80s, there was more people holding dollars that were not backed by gold than there ever were people who held dollars that were backed by gold.
Mm-hmm. Then I think that touches on an interesting question, this question of do you in fact have to have something, some tangible, hard tangible asset backing the paper? Does for people to have faith in the currency and its value, do they have to somehow believe that, not that they perhaps would do it, but that they could go get something really solid that they could, like a lump of gold they could hold in their hand? Or is the fact that people believe in the currency and agree that it's worth what we agree that it's worth, is that enough? And is it believing in it is enough so that the hard, tangible commodity that backs it up isn't really necessary?
Well, for most of the history of currencies, people have always insisted on this, gold, silver, or some other form of collateral. But I think what was happening by the late 20th century was the growth of both the U.S. and global economies were being artificially constrained by the fact that the currency had to be backed by a metal that, you know, was of very limited supply around the world. And after the U.S. went off the gold standard and it was able to print more dollars and it was able to borrow more money abroad because it wasn't worried about this ratio of gold to dollars, U.S. economic growth took off, world economic growth reached unprecedented levels, and I think it's hard to imagine that happening if the U.S. felt constrained by a gold standard. Now, the downside to that is something that we may yet experience. Without the restraint of having some collateral, the U.S. can continue to borrow money from abroad, can continue to print more dollars, and the feeling among most economists is at some point, and no one knows when that point is, they're just going to push it too far, and people will lose faith in the ability of the U.S. to honor all its debt and to honor all its dollars. We may even be near that point now. We may be far from that point now. But without any sort of collateral tied to it, you just have to keep sort of going forward and hope you figure it out before the rest of the world wants to dump their dollars.
Yeah. We're just about at our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll get right to. And again, I want to introduce our guest, Craig Carman. He works for the Wall Street Journal. He's a reporter for the money and investing section of the paper. He covers international markets and foreign exchange and is the author of a newly published book titled Biography of the Dollar. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Nearby community in Belgium is calling. Line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hello, sir. I want to put something to you in a little bit, sort of a strange way. I'm not sure I can explain it. You're talking about a currency being valuable for being what it can represent or what it can buy, whether it can get a lot of gold or has a lot of faith in the United States or whatever it may be, as the backing of that currency. But it seems that the way the economies are going, they fluctuate up and down and they just move around with that currency. It seems that the currency today should be something a little bit different. And I propose to you that maybe a currency in the future would be something that would be, your product would be valuable by the way it could reduce the amount of carbon that's put into the atmosphere, the more help it gives to the nation. And that way everybody would be working for a common cause.
Well, that's certainly another a different way of looking at currencies. Just in terms of the value of the dollar and you know, whether it does go through periods of you know, weakening and strengthening. Typically, they last anywhere from 5 to 7 years. We are right now in the sixth year of this current dollar bear market. And what's significant, though, is that since the dollar started trading freely against other currencies in the early 70s, the bear markets have taken away more value from the dollar than the bull markets have gained back. So over that period, the dollar has lost something like 75 or 80% against other major currencies because what it loses in its downturns, it doesn't make up in its rallies. So in that sense, perhaps the caller is right that we're looking at a currency that is slowly losing value, and we may want to rethink what should be valued in a currency.
Thank you very much, sir.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about Paul Volcker, a former chair of the Fed, and maybe also about Alan Greenspan, who was a guy who I think a lot of people believe deserved at least some of the credit for the really hot economic times we had in the 90s particularly. And I think that some people have also been critical of Volcker and what it was he did. Do you think, in fact, that Paul Volcker was perhaps underrated as a Fed chair? And by the same token, I don't know, was Alan Greenspan overrated as Fed chair?
Well, in terms of Paul Volcker, I would say he was definitely underrated. And in fact, he's getting a bit of another sort of moment in the spotlight recently. I've seen him on TV and his name quoted again. After, you know, when I was working on this book, his name would often draw sort of blank stares from people in finance today. It was sort of shocking to think that people who were just starting out didn't know who this former Fed chief was. He probably more than anyone else was responsible for the dollar's comeback in the late 20th century. He was a deputy treasury secretary under Nixon, and he was one of the big proponents urging Nixon to move the dollar off the gold standard. And then when he became Fed chairman in 1979, he was the one who did what other Fed chief could not do, which was to push up interest rates high enough to squelch inflation and to prevent the dollar from continuing its tailspin. In hindsight, that seems like clearly the thing that had to be done. But at the time, it was extraordinarily controversial. Fed chiefs would raise interest rates, and they would see that the economy was really starting to suffer, and they would decide that interest rates had gone high enough, and they would start easing again. And sure enough, the economy would pick up, but inflation would creep back again, and it was just a cycle that looked like it might never end, and it's probably one that contributed to Jimmy Carter's loss in the presidency. Volcker was able to push interest rates up to just below 20%, finally kill inflation, sent the U.S. into one of the biggest recessions, probably the biggest recession it had since the Great Depression. He was vilified across the country. I remember home builders would send 2x4s to the Fed in the mail because they were telling him that they couldn't build homes anymore. No one wanted to finance them, so they might as well give them to him. But one of the things about Volcker was he didn't back down. He didn't hide from his critics, and he didn't apologize for what he was doing. He attended the National Home Builders Association conference, and I think it was like 1981 when interest rates were close to their peak as the keynote speaker. And he sort of stood up there and told people that if he was to cut interest rates now, then all the pain that they had gone through would be for nothing and the cycle would start all over again. And he sort of earned people's grudging respect even if they disagreed with him. And interestingly enough, Congress was just going crazy with all these interest rate hikes. And just at the point in which interest rates peaked and just before, as it turns out, Paul Volcker was about to start easing again, some members of Congress were actually writing up a bill that was going to force the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates, which, of course, was a desperate move and would violate the Fed's independence. But you could just get a sense of how much public pressure there was on Volcker. And the fact that he was able to choke off inflation really was a big part of the big bull market run in economic growth of the 1980s and into the 90s. As far as Greenspan, I don't know if I'm really in a position to say whether he was underrated or overrated, but clearly Greenspan went through a period in which economic growth was pretty strong, and he was there sort of just to keep the ship going straight ahead. And some now are wondering perhaps he should have been tougher, like Volcker was, so that the housing bubble that we're experiencing now might have been cut off sooner.
Well, we have several callers here. Let's talk with some more folks. Next up, Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, this is kind of a personal question. Being way, way, way down on the ladder, I have some funds in a money market account at this time, and then I have some other bits in an ordinary savings account. And I'm wondering if the savings account is protected under the, I think, a law that if you have less than $100,000 in ordinary savings, that it is safe. But I don't know about the money market.
I'm not as well versed in those sort of rules. I think you're right about the savings account. I'm not sure about the money market account. In the book, one of the things I talk about is a bank called EverBank, which is an online bank based in St. Louis that offers foreign currency savings accounts and certificates of deposit that offer interest rates that reflect the foreign rates. So, for example, in a country like Iceland, which has been in trouble recently, but was offering interest rates of around 14%, that would be the rate you would get on a CD there. But the thing to note about any of the foreign currency savings accounts where you can get these higher interest rates is they are not government protected. And while you could get higher rates if the currency falls against the dollar, that could erode much of the value you get.
that would apply to money market, which includes foreign markets?
These are foreign market accounts. They have about 20 foreign currencies you could either have as a savings account or it's essentially a money market, a certificate of deposit that runs for, I think they have.
So the U.S. dollar, my U.S. dollar would go into that money market account, and then it would be applied to foreign currencies at whatever the best rate.
Right. If you put in, say, $5,000 into a euro account, you would get the equivalent of $5,000 in euro, and you would get paid an interest rate, which will probably be around 4%, which is the European Central Bank rate right now.
It sounds like quicksand to me. All right. I thank you very much, sir.
All right. Let's go on here. We'll go to line number one. This is Urbana. Hello.
Is this line one?
Yes.
Yes, good morning. Hi. Hey, I was wondering if you might discuss the precursors to a turnaround of the dollar. And I'm thinking, in terms of policy, macro and microeconomic fundamentals, just if you could just discuss a few of those things.
Sure. I mean, I think what's interesting about this bear market for the dollar is it's been going on so long now that the reasons the dollar was sinking in the beginning are somewhat different than the reason it's been under pressure today. In 2002, when the bear market started, people were really focused on the U.S. foreign debt and its large current account or trade deficit. As the dollar has continued to weaken, that trade deficit has stabilized somewhat. But now we're looking at these other macroeconomic problems related to the credit crisis and all the bad debt held by the banks and whether this is going to push the U.S. into recession. If you talk to most economists or currency analysts, they think the dollar is actually quite significantly undervalued now, at least against the European currencies, the major European currencies, and that when the Federal Reserve indicates it's done cutting rates, and when the U.S. economy looks like it's bottomed, the dollar may, in fact, begin a new cycle in which it rises for a number of years. In terms of what Washington policy could do to help, I mean, I think the U.S. does have a big savings problem. So any sort of legislation that might encourage savings, whether it's some sort of higher taxes or other method, as well as a little less borrowing from overseas, I think those would be long-term efforts. Would
higher interest rates be included in that too?
Absolutely. Higher interest rates are one of the key components for a strong currency, probably more than anything else. The problem for the U.S. now is the Fed is trying to keep interest rates low to avoid a recession, or at least prevent what may be a current recession from getting any longer or deeper. There is some talk tomorrow that after the Fed cuts rates as expected, or if as expected, it may indicate a pause. If that's the case, that could bode well for the dollar, and if the Fed is able to stop at 2% and other countries start to cut interest rates because their cycle is just trailing ours by a little bit, it could mark the beginning of a new period of dollar strength.
Okay. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go on to someone else. This would be Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had two questions, maybe. One was, I'd like to hear your evaluation of Paul Krugman as an economist and his view of the economy. And the second question would be, to what extent do you think that the fact that globalization impacts the United States and the income of the 50% of the lower 50%, say the lower 70%, to what extent is that a phenomenon of globalization? To what extent is it a phenomenon of, like, the economic powers in the country manipulating the situation so as to, like, keep labor's share of the economic pie low? And what do you think?
Well, that's a tough question there. In terms of Paul Krugman, I read his column in the Times from time to time. I don't really have a strong opinion on where he's coming from. He seems to be writing as much about politics as he does about economics these days. In terms of your second question, it's tough now. We're seeing a period in the credit crisis in which you know, we could be heading into a recession that's going to hit a lot of people across the country, and Wall Street will probably not be exempt from that. I really don't have much more to say on it than that, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Again, if you're interested in calling in, being part of the conversation, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest, by the way, is Craig Carman. He is a reporter for the Money and Investing section of the Wall Street Journal and is author of a new book, Biography of the Dollar, How the Mighty Buck Conquered the World and Why It's Under Siege. That's the subtitle. It's published by Crown Business. And we'll continue. Next, we'll talk with someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Another great program, as usual. I got two questions. They're interrelated, so I'll just ask them both and then hang up and listen.
Okay.
Number one, if we're no longer on the gold standard, then why don't they sell the gold at Fort Knox, and why did the in the World Almanac here they list gold reserves and ounces of gold for every country in the world? So if gold is just a commodity, I don't understand why they're doing this. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, you know, the gold standard is something that a lot of people feel passionately about, and there's still some economists and financial observers today who would like to see us go back on the gold standard. I think Forbes is one of those people. I don't really think that is a realistic option given how large and complex the economy is today. If we only had 15% coverage for all the dollars out there in 1971, I'm sure that figure is much smaller today, which goes to your first question on why do we bother to keep the gold. I think it's sort of a diversified country will do. They want to keep a little bit of something in a hard commodity, even though it's something that we may never sell. I think you just want to hold different types of assets, you know, just to make sure you have, in the event of any, you know, in the event that the dollar ever plunges too hard, you have something as a counterbalance. The price of gold and dollars tend to move in the opposite direction. But you're also right. It's sort of funny that we have backed all our currencies up until recently with a precious metal that in the end is essentially a commodity. It's not like some of these other metals that are more useful in terms of building things. Gold really is just an ornamental object. And, you know, if the dollar is backed right now only by the full faith and credit of the United States, the value of gold is really determined only by people's desire for it, not for any inherent usefulness.
I want to return for just a second, and we'll get another call here, to something that you talked about a little bit earlier, and that response to the caller's questions about his own money. And that is, if people invest in stocks, the advice is that you should be diversified. And some people would say part of a well-diversified portfolio would be, if you're going to be investing in mutual funds, which most people do, would be to a mutual fund that puts money into the stocks of foreign corporations, and the idea is that somehow the world economy mirrors the U.S. in the sense that when we're down, they're up. So it's a way of trying to insulate yourself from the big swings. So it is possible that you can go out and you can invest in a mutual fund that invests in Asia or Europe or the entire world, something like that. Some people, I guess, would think that not only should you diversify your stocks, but you should diversify your cash. And that is what this fellow that you mentioned is who has this bank that you were talking about gives people the opportunity to do just that. Is that something? What sort of appeal is that? Is there in that? And does that? Do you think that somehow makes sense?
Well, let me go first to the first point you made about owning foreign stocks. I think the diversification argument, which has always been used for why you want to own stocks in Europe, Latin America, and Asia, has dried up a bit recently. Stock markets around the world tend to be highly correlated these days, and they're most correlated when something is going bad in the U.S. So when the U.S. stock market is falling, that's exactly the time you want your diversification to work and for your foreign stocks to go up or at least not fall so hard. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you're seeing everything sort of fall together. So I still think there's a lot to be gained from owning foreign stocks, but I think investors may want to start thinking of it more as the U.S. market capitalization is only 50% of the world, in fact, a little less than 50%. Why would you want to limit yourself to only half the good companies available out there? Start thinking in terms of global investing, and you can invest in companies around the world. The other reason for it is, in fact, the currency benefit. The foreign markets have outperformed the U.S. over the past 5 years, and that's in part because of performance, but I think it might even be a bigger part is the fact that those currencies have been strengthening against the dollar, which is boosting their dollar returns. In terms of getting currency exposure through a foreign currency savings account or CD, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, that's something to do if you feel strongly about a particular currency. What a lot of analysts will still say is the way to do it is indirectly, either through a foreign stock fund or a foreign bond fund. That way, you're still owning also an underlying asset, either shares in a company or a loan to a company or a country that will pay you a regular coupon payment. And if you have a portion of your portfolio in these foreign funds, dollar weakness is not going to hurt you as much, and you still be able to get some potential gains from the underlying stocks and bonds.
All right, let's go to Wellington for another caller here. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah. I'm a farmer in Iroquois County, and so this may not be an appropriate call, but it, being a financial program, I thought I would call and ask it. And I'm not a garden patch farmer, but full-time farmer in agriculture. But in our corner of the world right now, we don't understand all the talk for the past 6 months to a year about recession in the United States in the ag economy. All we see right now is extreme runaway inflation, both in income and expenses, and the lowest interest rates ever in my career here. And I'm planting a 46th crop this year, so you know I'm a little bit of a veteran at it. So that's my comments and the question, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, I think he raises an excellent point that while the broad economy may be heading into recession, there are pockets that are looking at rising prices, and it could become potentially a problem for the United States because the blunt tool of interest rates can really only address one problem at a time. Either you're trying to get low interest rates to stimulate demand, and it's very clear that the weakening housing market is causing problems around the country. But he's absolutely right that in terms of crops, there is inflation issues there. And, I think the unfortunate news is the Fed is right now focused on preventing a deep recession, although I think you are starting to hear some people pay attention to signs of inflation, which is why when it meets this week, there may be some signs that it's going to pause from its interest rate cuts and want to see if those are working before cutting any deeper because, it doesn't seem to be a priority at the moment. They're clearly starting to worry about inflation. Just, again, the catch-22 is you can only fight one at a time. You can't fight them both.
Do you think that we are in a recession now?
There's a lot of economists who think so. If you define a recession as two straight quarters of negative GDP, we may be in the first one. It's really hard to say. I think the consensus is that some sort of recession is going to be hard to miss. It may be something as shallow as what we saw earlier this decade, where it was technically a recession, but it was just sort of a modest decrease in growth. I don't think people are yet expecting the sort of deeper recession we saw like during the Paul Volcker years in the early 80s. But what's been so difficult about this particular economic period is the lack of transparency in what's going on. People just do not know how much more bad debt the banks have, how much they're going to have to write down. They don't know where a lot of the bad loans are being held. And they just don't know how much farther housing prices can soften. And, you know, you've been seeing a lot of reports about problems with subprime or even the group in credit quality that's just below subprime, known as Alt-A. But the default rate among the sort of prime borrowers has also been going up. It typically stays at less than 0.5%, and I believe it's now between 1.5% and 2%, which is quite an increase. It's not going to approach the numbers of subprimes, but just in terms of breaking from its norm, it has some people worried.
Yeah, this certainly it's a challenging time here where people are trying to figure out what to do with their money, particularly people who are of modest means and don't have an enormous amounts of money, and who want to put it somewhere where they can make some money with it, use their money to make some money, and they're interested in safety. The possibilities seem pretty limited, and when you look at the interest rates that are available now, they're pretty pathetic. What do people do, or is there really much that people can do?
Yeah, it's a really tough time. That's a very good question, and unfortunately, there's not a satisfying answer. You know, stock markets are down, bond yields are very low. This is both the case in the U.S. and overseas. The one asset class that has been doing really well is commodities, led, you know, by oil prices. But basically, the price of almost every commodity has been sky high recently. Problem with that is a lot of people think that that is now the newest bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think long term, it's probably a good idea to have a bit of your portfolio invested passively in commodities, say through a commodity index, I think I'd be a little hesitant to put much money there right now, because anytime something has had such a run-up, it's vulnerable to fall, as we saw with housing prices and the NASDAQ before that, and emerging markets in Asia and Latin America before that. So, I mean, I think the only thing to do right now is to sort of stay tight, keep your money in something simple you know, like money markets, and sort of wait and see what happens next. There doesn't seem to be any obvious place to go that, you know, or may of course appear that way 5 years from now. There's someplace obvious, but right now no one seems to have any bright ideas that are catching on.
Yeah. We're down here to the point where we have a couple minutes left. I guess one thing that I really feel like I have to ask you about, you write a lot about very various and sundry things in the book, but one of the things that you write about is the visit to the place where they make the money, where they print the paper money.
Right.
And I guess I just have to ask you, what was it like to be in the presence of that much money?
You know, it was a very weird experience. At one point, I went into a room where they store tanks of $100 bills. And this was a room probably about the size of a large high school gymnasium. And I was brought in with someone from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, which is the part of the Treasury Department where they print up all these dollars. And I looked around. It was just stacks and stacks of $100 bills between two pieces of green plastic that, when pressed together, looked like giant $100 bill sandwiches. And I asked him, how much money is in this room? And he looked around. He said, it's tough to say, but it's billions and billions of dollars. And just to walk into a room in which there is literally billions and billions of dollars of cash is a very odd experience. And at one point, he said, would you like to hold it? And I said, excuse me, he's like, would you like to hold some of this money? I said, why not? So he picked up what they call is a brick, which is about maybe a foot and a half long, of $100 bills stacked up and sealed, and that's worth $400,000. So he threw this brick onto my arms, which felt like you're holding a fire log, and I said, all right, what about one more? So he threw a second one on. Now I'm holding $800,000, And I said, wow, you know, I'd love to know what it feels like to hold $1.2 million in my arms. And he looked at me and said, well, I don't think you're ever going to feel that. You're starting to enjoy this too much. So he took the money back. But, you know, just the thought that there is just so much money in one room, it makes you a little nervous. And, in fact, the people at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing told me that their building in Washington was rumored to be one of the potential targets for the plane on 9/11 that was shot down in Pennsylvania, because they seem to think people realize if you are able to destroy that much U.S. currency, it would have a terrible effect on the U.S. economy.
Would it, in fact? I'm sure that the shock, the initial shock, would be serious. But isn't there enough currency in circulation? Wouldn't they just be able to print up a bunch more and fairly short order?
Well, the printing process takes from beginning to end, it was three to five weeks, I think. And, you know, again, it goes back to this idea of confidence. There is nothing that backs the currency other than the full faith and credit of the U.S. So even if people were somewhat mistaken, if they suddenly thought that there was not enough dollars to go around, you know, and two-thirds of the dollars are held overseas, which means the U.S. doesn't really have access to them, it can create a bit of uncertainty, and that could reflect itself in the value of the dollar declining. One of the other things that came up in the Bureau of Engraving and Printing is all these new anti-counterfeiting measures. And counterfeiting history is very interesting. It was something that was the Germans tried to counterfeit the British pound in an effort to undermine their economy, thinking if people lost faith in the value of the pound, they couldn't tell the real from the fake, they wouldn't take British money for weapons. And then the Brits did the same thing and tried to counterfeit marks to undermine the German economy. And the U.S. itself has even used this tool to try and undermine Castro or the North Vietnamese. There is a note out there now known as the super note that is suspected coming from North Korea that looks so identical to the U.S. $100 bill that from the naked eye cannot tell the difference. In fact, the only way you can tell the difference is there's some tiny flaws there that the BEP suspects were put there intentionally so the North Koreans wouldn't confuse it with the real thing. But in some ways, they told me that some of the details on the $100 bills, the counterfeit, were even finer than what was made in the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, because they're in Korea making a very limited number of them, while we're cranking out something like 9 billion notes annually.
We're going to leave it there. Our guest, Craig Carman, is a reporter for the Money and Investing section of the Wall Street Journal. His book is Biography of the Dollar, published by Crown Business. Craig, thanks very much.
David, thank you for having me.